Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe, titled German Political Culture, Changes and New Challenges. Our speaker is Carsten Vogt, Senior Associate Fellow and member of the Presidium of the German Council on Foreign Policy. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Pardee School Professor of the Practice of International Relations, Joseph Whipple.
Carsten Vogt is a former member of the German Bundestag, serving there from 1976 to 1998. He also served as the coordinator for German-North American cooperation at the Foreign Office from 1999 to 2010. He has served as a vice president and then president of the Parliamentary Assembly of NATO, which is the parliamentarians from various NATO countries. From 1983 to 1998, he served as the foreign policy spokesman for the Social Democratic Party of Germany. One of the great people around, he served in the Aspen Institute for German-American Relations and as a senior associate fellow and member of the Presidium of the German Council on Foreign Relations. So without further ado, it's a great guest to have, and welcome him, and it's all yours.
Thank you. I've been in my youth chairman of the Young Socialist, and I've been looking at WikiLeaks. And I found a couple of reports about me dating from the early 70s. So I know that your agency has been working on me for some time.
We never give up.
Anyhow, when we once met in Langley, it was in the beginning of the Iraq War. I was very happy that we had our own intelligence services, because my impression at that time was that the reports which I got from your side were, to put it mildly, a little bit one-sided, and you, in your analysis. But when you would have asked me about meeting a person like him in my young socialist time, I never could have imagined it, or meeting anybody from any intelligence services. But this is part when you have a job as a foreign policy speaker of a party that you deal with these issues and learn to deal with them in a complicated environment, very often complicated environment. When we were meeting today, we were speaking Danish with one another because we discovered that we both have been studying in Denmark in different times. So I speak Danish, you speak Danish, which is not so often that somebody does it. And when I was studying in Denmark, it was in 1961, a couple of years after World War II, and I had a Danish girlfriend at that time. The family was shocked that she had a German girlfriend. And I was studying German occupation history in Denmark. I had tried to observe a complicated phase of German history, and I wanted to view it with the eyes of an outsider, which later on, by the way, helped me very much in my political career, because what I always did before I went to another country, that I studied the history of those countries. And I was trying to organize some maps, how they were describing the history. Not how I saw it, but how they were describing the history. And this is something which is, I think, still needed today, that you analyze the policy and the culture of your own country, not only by looking at it with your own eyes, but also observing it with the eyes of the other. And at that time when I was studying in Denmark, naturally the family was not only shocked that the girl had a German boyfriend, but at that time I also was considering Denmark to be more liberal than Germany, the political culture to be more liberal than Germany. At that time, 45 was the end of World War II, but it was not the hour zero, as many Germans said, because the people were still around who were active in World War II. And I had a debate is too much, but when I had an exchange of views with our foreign minister at that time, Genscher, who was there forever. And I criticized him that there were more former Nazis in leading positions in the Foreign Office than during World War II, which was quite obvious because the older people belonged to German nobility and they were extremely conservative and the Nazis were not fine enough for them. So there were especially the young people who joined the National Socialist organizations, and therefore there were more of them left after World War II. And Genscher asked Willy Brandt to contradict me. Brandt, having German Chancellor, having been in exile, and having been living through this period of the complicated German history, never contradicted me because he supported my view. I say that because at that time, German culture was very conservative, very conservative. And Germans in the United States felt more comfortable with the Eisenhowers and the Midwest and not with the coastlines, where they suspected that there was some prejudice against the Germans. If you decoded this language, they feared the Jewish influence and the negative view of Jews on Germany, which was understandably there. And when you now ask Germans where they like to be most, it's New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Miami, and this area. And when you ask how Germans would have voted in American elections, the last conservative president, Republican president, who got a majority of Germans on his side was Bush Sr. Because he supported German unification in a more logical way, seen from our point of view, than the French and the British. And he was supported by the majority of Germans. Since then, all Germans, by a margin of 70 to 80%, would have voted for the Democratic president. And this is 60 to 70% is about roughly the percentage how American Jews would have voted. Also 60 to 70% in favor of a Democratic candidate. What does it say? That political cultures are there, but they change over time, can change over time, to the better or to the worse. And this, I will make some introductory remark about how this is happening, or was happening in Germany. After World War II, when I was studying, as I said, in Denmark, I interviewed people from the resistance movement, but I also interviewed people from the SS and from the armed forces. They were there in Schleswig-Holstein more than in other places of Germany. And they were part of normal German day-to-day life. Those who were in exile, they had a more difficult time in Germany at that time because they were accused in parliament sometimes of not having lived the truth. That's what Dräger once said. Not been living in Germany during the difficult times of war, but have had a fine life outside, which was not their impression, especially not the impression of those who fled from Germany at that time. But at that time, the consensus in the average consensus in German politics was, especially on the former conservative side, that Nazis made a mistake. We condemn that period, but we are building up a new republic, and we fight together against communism. And the danger of communism, that was us, the young socialists. We were afraid of the right wing because we didn't consider them as normal conservatives. We saw them as being influenced by the personalities and the spirits of the time before 45. This was our suspicion. And they were very often supportive of Spain, which was a dictatorship. They were very often supportive of the racist regime in South Africa, also even our ambassador in the Foreign Office at that time. And they were very supportive of many later on in Chile, of many. There, you were involved as well, not you personally, but your agency. And at least there we were very skeptical. We were very skeptical about their mindset. And they were very skeptical about us being too soft on the left-wing side. I mean, you know this language. In the United States, it's a modern language, which you now hear in the United States again. But at that time, it was the language which you heard in those political circles in Germany, which led to a situation in which Germany was highly polarized, extremely polarized, ideologically polarized. And over time, this polarization continued, but Germany changed. And it changed, I will not spend too much time on that, where our former boss, Joschka Fischer, was a street fighter in Frankfurt, later on became the foreign minister. And so he was an anarchist. I was only a left-wing socialist, democratic socialist, so a moderate, seen with his eyes. And later on we worked together in different forms. But anyhow, there was, on the one side, the student movement. And unlike in the U.S., the student movement went into politics to a high degree. In the United States, it was more of a cultural movement. And many of those went into university life. This is at least how I see it as an outsider, that there were very few who really went actively into realpolitik. In real political life, they were not running for office. They were not in the executive branch. They were more at the universities, the so-called blue areas in the United States. But in Germany, very often they went into politics. Some of them are still around, most of them, Chetin, a Green member of parliament. But most of them naturally are now leaving German politics, but they were around. And I think the debate which they had with their parents, in the generation of their parents, what have you done in World War II, was starting then, in the 60s. I myself was in the early 60s at the Auschwitz trial. The general prosecutor, Bauer, asked me, because I was young enough not to have been part of the old system, to accompany witnesses, so I accompanied that. And my question, which I always was asked by Americans, what did Germans do? And how logical it was that Nazism came about in Germany. For me, it was a different question. What would I have done? That's a very different question which you ask yourself. And what did your parents do? And how it could happen? I had a debate with Goldhagen, who was intellectually active here in that region at Harvard. He wrote a book about it. And he saw a logical life from the 19th century to the Nazis taking over in Germany. I saw it in a very different way. Germany in the 19th century was not so anti-Semitic as France, and by far less anti-Semitic than Poland or Russia at that time. And it was a situation in which reform, this Jewish culture, started in Germany, in which you discussed about emancipation and integration. And the first female rabbi was in Germany. There's now a new one again in Berlin. But at that time, I asked myself, how could it happen in a relatively enlightened country, which had not a parliamentary strong parliament, but it had a parliament, who, by the way, introduced voting rights for females, for women, slightly earlier than the U.S. And so in the 19th century and early on, in the early Weimar time, there were a lot of problems, but in spite of Versailles, which didn't help very much, of the First World War, we had much more democratic culture than, for example, in Poland at that time, or in Hungary, in a certain way, with the exception of a short period. So the question was, for me, why did it happen in Germany in spite of the intellectual tradition, the liberal tradition which was there? And This debate, which was not only a personal debate, led to a reassessment of certain values, of risks. There was a risk feeling that German political culture was not immune insofar as right-wing tendencies are concerned. In the 60s, we had for the first time, again afterwards, no, not the first time, but second time, again in German parliaments, also in the region where I was came from at that time, where I was living in the state of Hessen, there was a right-wing, extreme right-wing neo-fascist party called NPD, National Democratic Party. And they got seats in several parliaments. So our problem was that, not what has been, what has happened in the 30s and 40s with World War II and during Nazi time. Our debate was how we could prevent it. And therefore it's a debate about how do you change the political culture and the institutions that you are protected against this coming up again. And there we have drawn, as Americans and as Germans, different conclusions. In the U.S., you have, for example, let all flowers blossom, and then the debate will lead to a result in which the extreme will be sorted out. This was you are a centrist country, middle ground country, the extremes will never win, and by public debate, the problem will be sorted out. We had a different impact, saying in our political culture, start to kill them early. Start to kill these enemies of democracy early. I mean, I'm a little bit brutal in my language, but this, we were students speaking in such a way. Prevent them before they take over. And start early. What we called defense of democracy, which meant, for example, that freedom of speech was limited. If you misused it for propagation of racist or anti-democratic policies. So in that sense, and after 9/11, we changed our law again that if inside a religious institution, meaning a church, a mosque, or a synagogue, hatred against other religions are preached, or the undermining of the German constitution is preached, this is a illegal offense, will be prosecuted, and which is impossible in the United States. We said freedom of speech, yes, but we very often had the problem that the Nazi propaganda was printed in the U.S. and transported to Germany, which was illegal, yes. And by the way, also from Denmark coming to Germany, not only from the United States. And we were in Germany, this was illegal and is illegal. So we have a different concept of, in a certain way, there we have a different concept how to deal with right-wing extremism. And for the matter, natural also with extreme anti-democratic left-wing extremism. This is where our historical experience has led to different experiences and different cultures, political cultures. Oh, in the last 20 years, after unification, many of the traditional divisions were in German politics were fading away because Soviet Union was gone, so there was no longer this threat perception that somebody could be a fellow traveler of those. There was no fellow over there. On the other side, the old Nazis were dying out. And the Christian Democratic Party of today is not the Christian Democratic Party of the 50s, or the Liberal Party, which were, by the way, at that time even influenced more by former Nazis in the 50s. So it changed in a certain way. And when you now look at German politics and view it with the eyes of an outsider, not as an insider, you cannot compare Corbyn, British Labour Party, with the leadership of the German Social Democratic Party. Seen with German eyes, it's a version of social democracy which might have been modern for some weeks in the late 19th century, but not much later. And when you view Angela Merkel, while I'm in a different party, I'm a social democrat, I would not consider her to be extremely right-wing orientated. She would fit into the Democratic Party in the United States. And so the Social Democrats would be another wing inside the Democratic Party. The Greens would be the center wing in the Bernie Sanders wing inside the Democratic Party. And the liberals might on economic issues be closer to the Republicans, but not very close on civil rights issues, anyhow not. So if I leave, the only one which might be considered in the American context, present context, after we have had these changes in the Republican Party, might be similar to the Republican Party is the right-wing populist Alternative for Germany. All the others, where we fight one another inside Germany, seen with American eyes, are part of the Democratic Party consensus or non-consensus. Which means that our culture has changed. And in a certain way, that's not the only reason, we have other reasons as well, but in a certain way, the revival of this old right-wing tendency is also a result of the Conservative Party, the former Conservative Party, the Christian Democratic Party, of moving more to the center. The extreme right wing was not represented in parliamentary politics. And the problem is now for the Christian Democrats to take those conservative votes, to integrate those conservative votes again, without becoming right wing populist. They are trying to do that, I see that, but in the same way, in a certain way, the Social Democrats have their responsibility on the other side. But the situation is that they were not represented, and then we had the two factors which are the reason, again, for a challenge in the German political debate. This is, on the one side, the integration of the two parts of Germany, East and West. I mean, the East Germans wanted to be unified with Germany, but not with the rest of the world. They want to travel there, but they don't want that those people whom they visit there then afterwards come to their district. And they were not, I'm overestimating it, but I'm overdoing it, so the argumentation is clearer. And therefore, they didn't have the same experience with migrants as we had in Germany over a couple of decades. In East Germany, the percentage of migrants normally is around 1%. Might be lower in many cases, but it's around 1%. And the problem is that in those areas, very often, people were leaving the area because of lack of employment, because opportunities were greater in West Germany. Unemployment rate was slightly higher than in West Germany. The headquarters of the big companies were in West Germany, not in East Germany. But the immigration of migrant workers didn't happen to the East because there was no job. So there were few workers who went there. And now, because of our distribution system, the asylum seekers came there. Asylum seekers and refugees. Why? Because in Germany, which is not typical for the US, if you are an asylum seeker and if you are accepted as an asylum seeker, you have, after 3 months, access to welfare. And not a qualified, but anyhow a minimal standard of housing, sometimes in camps. But anyhow, you get shelter. You get free medical care. And a certain amount of pocket money, about 150 euro in a month. A welfare, if you later on get welfare, is up to 400 euro in a month, which means you get more than you get paid for in Kosovo or in Albania or in Ukraine. And therefore, they went there, and we had conflicts. And therefore, because the distribution of social welfare is the obligation of the local authorities, not the central government is supporting these social measures by, I think, roughly 4 billion euro in a year. But it's basically the task to distribute it is locally, and so the Germans are distributing the refugee in all parts of the country, even on the countryside. Therefore, they came there And there was a local uproar in many places. This is, I describe this as one element, but it's not the overall. There are other reasons why you have extreme right-wing tendencies in Germany. The one element which I mentioned, that there were you have the economic difficulties, you have the memory of a different society, you have a different tradition. You have a stronger element of these right-wing populists in East Germany than in West Germany, but you have it as well in West Germany. So it's not limited to East Germany. On the opposite, you have roughly, in East Germany now, and we will have regional election, we will have up to 20%, sometimes even more. In West Germany altogether, the numbers are 12-13%. Still much lower than in France or in a couple of other European countries, but relevant. And it is a challenge. We have now to discuss how to deal with it. The political debate in Germany is that there's always a tendency, there was also a tendency in some quarters of German politics to integrate them by appealing to their instincts, that's right-wing populism. But I think the dominant view, this is still the view of some, but I think the dominant view is to fight them early on. And this is a debate which we are now having, but this is a complicated debate because we have to deal in some European states, like in Hungary, with the same phenomenon. But Orban is prime minister of a country, of a member country of the European Union, of NATO. We cannot avoid to talk with him and sometimes to make compromises with him because we need his votes. Because some decisions in the European Union can only be taken if you have a total consensus, not by majority vote. So at the same time, you fight those domestically. At the same time, in one way or the other, you have to deal with them. What I never expected that this could happen, that the right-wing populists get some intellectual support from the United States. Bannon is traveling around in Europe to get the right-wing being organized without great success, at least not in Germany. But he is there, and your president is not totally in opposition to Bannon, to put it that way. So this anti-European instincts, this xenophobic tendencies, I always believed they were guaranteed in the U.S. And I always thought, when I was a child, whatever I criticized in American policy, the Vietnam War and so on, but on liberal issues, they would be better than we. Today, I would have a certain degree of doubt. This is our political challenge now, to deal with these new phenomenon, but not totally new phenomenon, because they are old elements, old traditions as well, of right-wing populism. It's not only a German phenomenon. It's an international phenomenon, not even only a European phenomenon. And the problem is that in realpolitik, you have to deal at the same time with those people representing those ideas when they are in power, while at the same time you try to prevent your country to be influenced by them. This is a complicated task which we now have. So having an authoritarian Putin on the one side and people who appeal directly beyond the institutions to the mood in the street on your side, it's complicated in our story, our history. And this is one of the big challenges for German political culture today, to contain those right-wing populist elements, to build alliances in Europe to prevent that on international level, while in a certain way, in terms of realpolitik, we have to deal with authoritarian governments, I mean like Putin, like Saudi Arabia, like Erdogan, and then continue with the policy of migration. And that's my final point. Germany was always an immigration country, but we never accepted it. We have in Berlin from the early 18th century, I think, we have two churches in the Gendarmenmarkt, the German Dome and the French Dome. At that time, in the center of Berlin, 25% of the population were French Huguenots who emigrated to Germany because at that time Germany was more liberal, Prussia was more liberal than France. And therefore, at that time, the Kurfürst, not quite a king, but close to it, he symbolized this tolerance by being in favor of the construction of these two churches. Later on in the 19th century, when the Prussians conquered Catholic areas, close to these churches, a Catholic dome was built. And in another part not far away, with the Golden Dome, the new synagogue was built, expression of the self-confidence of the emancipated German Jews. Now in Berlin, we have not only a debate, but we have decided on collected money for a new religious building, the House of One. House of One, where in one building, Muslim, Christian, and Jewish worships will be held. House of One. It's in a certain way a revival, the first building of that type worldwide. In a certain way, it's a revival of old traditions. On the other side, it's a modernized version of it because it includes Muslims as well. We have Muslim immigration. We have roughly, I don't know the exact figures by heart, we have roughly 5% Muslims in Germany. Quite a number in parliament and in leading position. For example, the chairman of the Social Democratic Parliamentary Group in Berlin is a German with Palestinian background. And so they have elected, they are elected to office in several occasions. There are quite a number of them. And not only in one party, in several parties. There are even the first Muslim people now in the Christian Democratic Party. This is something new. In the Green Party, anyhow, in the left-wing party, in the Social Democratic Party, they are quite common. But we had, after this Huguenot immigration, we had immigration from Eastern Europe in Prussian time, in German time. Many Jews were emigrating to Germany in the 19th century. After World War II, we had 30 million refugees being fleeing or being kicked out of the former German territories in the east. We had several million people leaving, fleeing from the GDR. After 89, when the wall was not built, prior to the wall being built, we had in the so-called guest workers who quite of a sudden decided to stay there to the surprise of some others. But anyhow, they came as Turks, and now the question is whether we accept them as Germans and whether they accept that they are Germans. You always have two sides of this equation. We have roughly 3 to 4 million with Turkish background. 50% of them have German citizenship. The other 50% can still vote in Turkish elections. So we have Turkish election campaigns inside Germany, which is also a challenge. Erdogan trying to speak in Germany, not always welcomed, sometimes not even allowed to campaign in Germany. After 89, we took roughly Katharina the Great, the Russian Tsar with German background. She was inviting Germans to settle in Russia at that time. After they hit, Stalin then put them in certain places in Kazakhstan and Siberia. Anyhow, after 89, roughly 1.5 to 2 million people, Russian Germans, who were Germans by citizenship then. The citizenship was given to them immediately, but many of them couldn't speak German. And had to integrate them. Then we had roughly 200,000 Russian Jews decided not to go to Israel, but not to go to the United States, but to Germany. So we have now a new generation of Jews there. In Berlin, by the way, which is not a German phenomenon, it's a Berlin phenomenon, we have roughly between 10 and 20,000 Israelis living there. And liberal Israelis mostly coming from the Tel Aviv region, not the conservative one, the ultra-Orthodox one from Jerusalem. And now we have several immigration problems. So what you discussed most in the last years, which was observed here, was the refugee movement, the asylum seekers from Syria and other parts of the Arab world. This was a very high number in 2016, and but the number has now gone down to slightly below 200,000 in a year. And these 200,000, if they are accepted as refugees, can stay in Germany. They can, in that period, they get language training. Their children have to go to school after 3 months of being in Germany. It's a duty to go to school, which sometimes it's complicated to implement, because some of the asylum seekers are Roma or Gypsies who cannot read and write, the parents, and nobody speaks Romanesh, meaning the Roma language. So this is sometimes very difficult to organize it. But anyhow, these 200,000 people come, but the larger amount of and the largest group among these refugees are the Syrians. Among the Syrians, many opponents of Assad, but because you cannot always control, there are also some supporters of ISIS among them. And some refugees have discovered that some of the police forces who were paining them have been among those refugees. So it's a complicated issue, also a complicated issue for our security services. But the largest groups of immigrants are not those being refugees. The largest group are from inside the European Union. We have a rule, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why Britain wanted to leave the European Union. We have a rule inside the European Union that we do not only have a common market, but also a common labor market, which means that everybody in the European Union has a right to look for a job for 6 months in any country where he wishes to be. And after if he doesn't find a job, he has to go back, which very often they don't do. And the question is how you get them going back. And these numbers are the highest. The largest group which we received in the last 10, 15 years were traditionally the Poles. The Poles are now in numbers after the Turks and the Poles are now in numbers. They were, and the Turks, and there was another group, I forgot that, but anyhow, the Poles were the largest immigration group to Germany after the Turks. In the last years, it has changed. The largest group are now the Romanians. And the Romanians and the Poles are second. And then we have now Syrians and then Bulgarians. But these numbers are relatively high. And it means that Germany, who has a shrinking birth rate, or had a shrinking birth rate, it's now stable on a very low level, that Germany's population was growing in spite of it. So German population is growing. But the ethnic composition of the country is changing. And statistically, you can say we have 10 million people who have a migrant, who are in one way or the other being migrants. If you take a migrant background, their forefathers, it's about 20%. And the number is growing. And you have a situation in which this number is concentrating. Statistically, these are 10%. But in the area where I am living, more than 50% of the population have a non-German background in Berlin, Moabit. Roughly 50% Turks and 50% Arabs, or 40%, and the rest are third parties. And it's concentrating. It's also concentrating in the big cities in certain quarters. In those quarters, you very often have schools where you have 80% of the children being of non-German background, which creates another type of problems. So I'm not minimizing the problem, but I'm only saying Germany is changing. In spite of it, which surprises me, the bad news, you have sometimes good news, the German population is not full of anxieties. You have anxieties, but we have just, the Friedrich Ebert Foundation has just made a research that you have a situation in which 20% of supportive, extremely supportive and welcoming for new people, 20% are totally negative, and the rest is open-minded, sees it as an advantage for Germany, but with certain caveats, meaning that if people are unemployed and can't get a job, they are reluctant to support them, because this means spending more welfare. If they have a job, they, even if juridically you have the right to send them back, because they don't are not refugees, the majority of those center people, the last, these 40%, 50%, would say, let them stay, because they are serve a purpose for German economy. And they, these people have a tendency to say, we cannot welcome all, but we can welcome those whom we have now. So they are not against migration. In principle, they are only against migration when it's not controlled. So they are in favor of limited migration. Therefore, Germany will now adopt a law. This is part of the coalition agreement between Social Democrats and Christian Democrats. For the first time in its history, an immigration law, thereby redefining German identity. Because it's not only about legal aspects, it's about redefinition of identity. And we have the problem, what does it mean to be German? By heritage? By citizenship? Or by supporting the basic principles of the German Constitution? And this is naturally a problem, especially for the majority society, but it's also a challenge for those who come. Because those who come from Syria will not automatically accept our commitment for Israel. Those who come from Anatolia, not to speak about other countries, have a different vision of the equality of male and females. And I leave aside the language problem. So we have had, in my environment, honor killings where family members were killing a young girl because she had a German boyfriend before marriage. This is not, in numbers it's not big, but it shocks the society. In the area where I'm living, we have a liberal mosque where a female imam is preaching and she accepts homosexual amongst the Muslim community. But not far away from that, we had a Salafi community where Amrin, a later terrorist, were listening to the speeches in the mosque and then he was killing in a terrorist attack a lot of people in the center of Berlin. So I'm saying, yes, we are on a new way to redefine our identity. This will be a complicated process. It will, by the way, lead to a situation in which many nationalities have, while they are Germans, still relate to their home country. Either they oppose it, which is also a relationship. They ask the German government to act against it, or they might be supportive. We have both elements, sometimes both at the same time, and they are fighting with one another on German soil. So a lot of the history, the problems of the countries surrounding Germany in the Mediterranean and in Eastern and Southeastern Europe are now becoming problems on our soil. This will redefine German political culture. It's an ongoing process. You will not solve it in one day. It will take decades. It's, I think, on the other side, when I compared and I started with that, with my Danish experience. At that time, Germany was seen as a problem forever. Now we are perceived as a problem if we don't do something. When I started in foreign policy, nobody wanted mobile armed German forces. They were feared about, they were fierce in our neighborhood about German military mobility. Now, what many Germans do not accept, because they don't accept the demands which result from that. We have our neighbors and the U.S. asking us to export stability and not only to consume stability. And German troops, we have deployed them in Mali to, because we have to help the French, because otherwise we can't get their support in Ukraine. We have troops being deployed in the Baltics, also something new. And I met a Russian, which I do very often, and he said, Carsten, for us Russians, it's quite a new element, and you have to understand it, that you are intermediating between us and the Ukrainians. So we have a political role in parts of Europe and a role which is new for us, where we are learning, and we have in some places a limited military role. And in so far, this change of a political culture is an ongoing process. Seen with my eyes, there are always problems, there are challenges, but when I compare it with our situation in the 50s, it's finally a success story. Thank you very much.
Okay. The question is, what are the expectations by Germans of German leadership in Europe and the expectation of others? You've touched on that, but not in detail.
If you translate leadership into German, it sounds a little bit negative, Führung, or Führer. We exert a certain leadership, but we don't exert a leadership alone. We always do it together with the French, which is we have to work together not because we are identical, but because we differ. And therefore, we have to find a compromise. And what is sometimes not easy for the French to understand, even France and Germany is not enough. We need to get a couple of other countries on board as well, especially of the smaller countries. And which means when you defend German interest, you need a broad definition of national interest, because a narrow definition of national interest would isolate you from your neighbors. And you need to respect and engage in a way in which certain elements of their national interest are integrated as well. So a German national interest, which only pursues in the narrow sense German interest, will isolate Germany in this European context. We need a broader definition of national interest, which then means for us multilateralism is a must. It's not a possible option, it's a precondition. And this means not that we are soft or unwilling to lead, it only means that we have tried it by dominance. It was not very successful. And we did it for the wrong purposes. So this is the way in which we learn from history. And this is an intellectual debate which we're now having across the Americans. By the way, how we were leading, with formerly the European Union leading, in the Brexit process was a typical example. The British expected that the 27 would fall apart. Not the 27 were falling apart, the Brits were falling apart. Not we did, because we wanted that, but our first priority was to keep the Europeans together and to let the institutions and the policy of the European Union not be undermined by whom whatsoever. And this is a soft way of leadership. Germans are active in this process, but the visible parts are the European Commission and the Council of Europe. And then sometimes you get a statement from Berlin saying that we are consulting with the other Europeans about something. And then we travel to Paris, or Paris travels to Berlin. So this is a different style of leadership also, but it is also leadership.
Thank you. And maybe time will tell. I'm struck by how rich the differences are of the constituencies in Germany that you're having to deal with now, with all these conflicts.
Yeah.
And I imagine, just as Brexit may be cohering the European Union in a certain way, that populism from the United States could also be helping to cohere something more palatable. But that might.
But that's a negative unity. That's a negative unity. I mean, by defining a common problem, you have an unstable cohesion inside the European Union. We need more than that. We need, for example, that Hungary, a country which on one side is against migration, on the other side is against building up a common border guard, Frontex. So we need to solve these practical issues as well, and this there, Trump is not an excuse. We need our own dynamic and our own solution, and we cannot blame others for that. That is our task, so to say. And there the question of German leadership comes in. And I mean, for example, when I go to Poland, I have there been a fortnight ago, I said to them, I understand that you are have a negative sentiment about the Russians. That's your history. I understand that you have a negative sentiment about the Germans because this is also part of your history. But two at the same time, it's not totally realistic. So you have to decide about your preferences. And I'm saying that, and we should not make an outcry. We should also talk with them in such a way that it might change the one or the other perspective.
Well, thank you, Carson Voigt. Thank you, Joe Whipple. It's been a really exciting discussion, and thank you so much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture titled German Political Culture, Changes and New Challenges by Carsten Vogt, Senior Associate Fellow and member of the Presidium of the German Council on Foreign Policy. His lecture was presented by the Boston University Pardee School of Global Studies and the Center for the Study of Europe. Tonight's moderator was Pardee School Professor of the Practice of International Relations, Joseph Whipple. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.